Good afternoon. So, last time when Skydron was lecturing for me, I believe you went over exec. So we talked about fork for creating processes, and we had this counterpart exec, which changes what program is running in a process. We load a new program, but we use the same process that we already started, usually with fork, not necessarily. We also mentioned that, well, you know, we have a way of creating processes. We want to actually do things with the process we create besides like killing them. We want to wait for them to finish. And we have a mechanism for that, which is wait or wait PID. And it has that property that we can only wait for processes that we created with fork. And it is going to let us retrieve sort of how the process exited, which we'll talk about briefly at the beginning as our one of our first topics today. And overall, this gives us this common pattern where we run fork and exec and wait PID, you know, to do the task of like you type a command of the shell, like you type ls. Basically what the shell is doing is running fork to make a new process, exec to make that new process be running ls instead of the shell, and then wait PID to wait for that process to finish before prompting you for the next command. And this pattern comes up all over the place. It also comes up in some homework assignments we have coming up. It's basically sort of how we run programs the normal way. And we mentioned something else that our shells do besides just running programs is that we can run programs and have their input and output come from or go to places that aren't the normal place. And the way this works is that, well, we have to think of how does the program know where to output to begin with? And each process has associated with it a bunch of open files. And these open files, some of them are kind of considered by default to be these normal input, the normal output, the normal error output. And what they're set to is just what the process starts with. Whatever files we have open when we call exec, those are going to still be open after we call exec by default. So if we want to change where a process writes its output to, we just need to change what the open file that conventionally is used for output is open to. Change it from being open to, for example, the shell output to being open to a file on disk. And when we do that, we can implement what shells call redirection. Now, to do that, we needed some way of changing what an open file was assigned to. And we learned that the way that works on Unix-like systems is that each open file has a file descriptor, so an index. And basically what's happening is that the OS has an array for each process of the open files, and the file descriptor is just an index in that array. And we just have decided that index 0 is standard in, index 1 is standard out, index 2 is standard in. But we can't access that array directly, so we want some way of assigning particular entries in that array to a new value. And our primary way of doing that is the dupe2 system call. So if we get a file descriptor, for example, from opening a file, we can use dupe2 to assign that to a particular entry in the array. So questions about these things we covered last time? Yeah?
So does wait PID wait for the exec in the child?
Question is wait PID?
Wait for the execute in the child.
Does it wait for the execute in the child? Wait PID waits for the process to exit in some manner, either by calling exit or by crashing. It doesn't care what program is running in that process. So when wait PID is waiting for PID 1000, if PID 1000 changes from running the shell to running ls, wait PID is still going to keep waiting for PID 1000. It doesn't care that exec happened and it's running a different program now. It's still the same process. Wait PID waits for a process, not a program. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so I probably should talk briefly about quiz question one. So quiz question one, we had this mystery code. This is wrong here, but, you know, returns in sort of every parent. We will drop this option because there are multiple interpretations. So in quiz question one, we had this code that forks and returns PIDs from the fork. The way that code was written is it returned in every parent side of the fork. So this meant that the code that it returned to could success, has all the PIDs to wait for, and it can call wait PID and wait for all of them. Something that was not nice with question A is that we used the word process, which confused some people because they were concerned that there were children of children, and could we wait for them in the right process? That's not a detail. We wanted you to realize you could wait for all the processes correctly, the way this function works. We didn't want to deal with the semantics of which process needs to do the waiting based on how the question's phrased. That was unintentional, so we'll drop this option for that reason. But something to realize is that the way the code works is that because we return when PID not equals zero, I believe, right? The PID, we get the PID. There is a return from mystery in multiple places that gets the PID of every child. So waiting is not hard. Yeah? Question, there are multiple return statements. So I think the reading that Skadron thought of for the question is that the original parent process only spawns one child. And that's the one we spawn, and we can print that PID. All the other parent child processes are not actually childs of the original parent, they're childs of others. So they weren't in scope with option A as phrased if you read it very literally. If you read it less literally, you can say we can wait for them in general, and in fact, we will have a return in each parent of a child process that we can do a wait for in, and we can output, and the total output should include everything. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
So I guess this is what you're talking about. The way I saw it, the question was saying, oh, is there a way for the original parent to wait on all the grandchildren, I guess?
So you said, yeah, the question is, you thought, right, is there a way for the original parent to wait on the grandchildren? And it can't do that directly. You are correct. Yeah, I think the reading that Skadron was thinking of is that those weren't made by the process that called mystery initially. Or alternately, they were made by one of the many processes that effectively called mystery, because fork means you copy the call to mystery, and you can wait anyways. But one of those two interpretations, but yeah, we didn't intend this other interpretation. Yeah.
If one of the middle processes failed, would you use all the ones that came after?
Question, if one of the middle processes failed, so like if it ran out of memory and crashed or something like that, would you label the processes next to it? Basically, so the rule that I don't think we went over is that if you don't wait for a child process, its parent process gets changed to a system process, and that is responsible for waiting for it and outputting its exit status to some log file somewhere. Does that answer your question? And so, other questions? Okay, so then talk about B and E, which when I, sorry, yeah.
Sorry, I had a question on one of the other answer selections. Should I ask that after?
Answer selections for one?
Yes.
Was it B or E?
I think it was actually C. Or it was the one that D referenced.
It was B.
Sorry, is B correct?
B is not correct. So we'll talk about B. So B was saying that, the assembly code for COM+1 will dereference a pointer. And there's no need for that because, and it said it dereference a pointer because the address is different in the two processes. And this is going to go into our topic today, which is that we talked about address translation. So that we have the program uses these virtual addresses, and that goes through a mapping to the physical addresses. And after forking, these are the addresses that are different, the physical addresses. But the virtual addresses are exactly the same. So there's no need to recompute the address of count. If we have it hard-coded, it's still going to be correct afterwards. So we can have assembly that just hard-codes the address we put count at when the program starts, and we can continue using that after fork, because fork makes the new mapping has memory in that exact same virtual address, and that's the only addresses we use in assembly, is virtual addresses. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Was this like in the slides somewhere, or was that like...
Was this in the slides somewhere? So this is when we talked about being an exact copy, except there's a new copy of the physical memory. This was meant to be an implication of that and how mappings work. So yes, this is one which requires some thinking beyond what was directly stated in the slides.
And then count was a global variable?
Count was a global variable in the code. So a possible way of writing assembly to access it is we could just like move count, comma, and that's going to turn into an address when it turns into machine code. Yeah?
So parent and child processes have their own count, like you're not talking about the same count because it's like global scope.
Question, parent and child have their own count?
Yeah.
Yes.
Even though it's like outside of the scope of the method?
Even though it's outside the scope of the method, yes, because the whole process is copied. So all the global variables we have a new copy of, including, and all the local variables we have a new copy. Yeah, we have. So everyone has their own count, but because we're making an exact copy of the process to start out with, everything has the same virtual address in both cases. Like the difference is at the physical addresses the mapping points to, those have changed, but all the virtual addresses in the mapping are going to be the same. And this is kind of necessary if we think about what's going on, because we're copying the stack pointer, right? We don't have a step where we change the stack pointer. So we have to keep the stack in the same place, and the stack might have a pointer to somewhere else. If we're copying that data, you have to keep that thing it's pointing to in the same place. So we have to keep everything in the same virtual addresses. Or else this idea of copying the whole process doesn't really work. And this is especially true because if you think of assembly, right? When you're writing assembly, you didn't tell the assembler whether RAX contained a pointer or an integer. And for that reason, not only does the assembler not know that, there's no way for the OS to know that. So it can't move things around. It doesn't have enough information to do that. Its only option is to keep things at the same virtual addresses. Okay, other questions? Okay, and for option E, does the stack pointer stay the same? Yes, because our calling convention says so, and because, as I mentioned, we can't actually move things around because we have all these pointers we need to keep valid, or else that whole copying the whole process doesn't work. We aren't really making a copy. Okay, so yeah.
So for E, would the child not have a separate stack pointer?
Question: would the child not have a separate stack pointer? It will. Its stack pointer will have the exact same value, but that will, because of our mapping, point to different memory.
Okay, so is it like on the question? It said like it'll have a different value. Would it have?
Yeah. Yeah, so the stack pointer's value is the same. The stack pointer value is like RSP if you look in the debugger.
Okay.
Right, that's the stack pointer. Yeah, so the value is the same. The memory it points to is different when the new process is active versus the old. Okay, other questions? Okay, so, and I'm only going over quiz question one because the other ones do not look problematic. So we have some things you want to finish up about kind of exit statuses and files. So gather exit statuses. So we talked about wait PID, it returns the status information. Let's talk about what that is. So there's this thing called an exit status. And as we'll see, this is not quite the thing that the status and wait PID refers to. It's not quite the same. It's related, but not the same. So when you have main and return a dot number from it, or you call exit with a number, that sets the exit status in this example to 0, because we're returning 0. We could return 1, 2, 3, and that would set it to 1, 2, or 3. So that sets an exit status. And we can retrieve this status from wait PID through the status variable that we can pass to it. So in our call to wait PID, we can specify a PID to wait for, or negative one if we don't care what PID we wait for. We can specify a pointer to a place to put some status information, and this gives us a status code that can include the exit status, but it can include some additional information. So here I have the mechanism the library gives us to decode that status code and extract that information. And I'm using this wifexited macro to check if the status is telling us the program exited by doing something like calling exit or returning from main. And if so, I can retrieve the number it passed with the wexit status macro. But that's not the only way the program could have exited. So for example, it could have segfaulted. I could have killed it and it didn't have a signal handler set. In that case, wait PID is going to actually tell us that that happened. In fact, this is why you see segmentation fault printed out in your shell. That's not actually done by the OS directly. That's done by your shell. When it runs a program, it forks it, execs it, and wait PIDs for it. And based on the return value of wait PID and the status it returns, it sometimes outputs segmentation fault. How does it know how to do that? It checks this wifSignal flag here to see if it exited due to a signal. And if the signal it retrieves with this wTermSig is sigSecFault, it knows segmentation fault, and it prints segmentation fault. And if wifSignal is true, the exit status is meaningful because the program never actually exited normally. It terminated in this other way. Some questions about our exit status retrieval. Okay. So when we talked about redirection, we mentioned that kind of execing preserves all the file descriptors, and the system actually handles cleaning up closing files from when file descriptors are, the last file descriptor that points to what's called an open file description is closed. And by closed, I mean it's closed with the close call, or it goes away because a program exits or something like that. And you might think, wait a moment, so isn't each file descriptor like independent of each other? And that's not quite true. So I'd like to go over sort of, where we can have kind of sharing of file descriptors. Because a file descriptor doesn't just tell us, so a file descriptor points to an open file description, and that doesn't just include what file it points to, it also includes other information, most notably, can we read or write it, and where in the file are we? So like if we're opening a file, we have to know where in the file we need to go. So the most notable, obvious form of kind of sharing that happens is that, if we have different open files, so like from separate calls to open, they'll have separate what's called seek pointer. So seek pointer is the name we're going to use for the pointer for where we are in a big file. So for example, if I have foo.txt contains AB, if I open it twice and read one character from one open, one character from the other, I'll read the same thing twice because we're reading at the beginning both times, and each file descriptor is independent of each other and keeps separate track of where it is in the file. We don't get two pointers to the same open file. They both work completely independently. And this is probably intuitive because this is how you're used to opening files working. And the reason we're talking about this, though, is that this is not how Duke 2 works. Duke 2 does not open a new copy of the file. It shares the open file description, including the seek pointer. So for example, if I open a file and use Duke 2 to make that file descriptor also be pointed to by, that open file also be pointed to by file descriptor 100. So now I have, I think of my open file table, I have file descriptor number and open file, I have FD is points to, you know, foo.text at 0, and when I call dupe 2, 100 points to the same thing. And it's really the same thing. And a way it's really the same thing is that when we read one character from FD here, that's going to set C to A, our first byte of the file, and we're going to advance from being at index 0 of the file to index 1. And that's going to change that open file description. And it's going to be the same one, because dupe 2 makes them point to the same place. It doesn't give us a new one. And this means that when we read from 100, we're going to access that new pointer, we're going to read a B, and we're going to advance this to 2. So questions on this notion that, you know, we're accessing the same open file description when we only have one call to open? And this same idea of referring to the same open file description also happens when we fork. So when we fork, we don't open the file again, so the two processes have the same open file description, they share a seek pointer, so if one reads, that advances the pointer the other reads will use. It's the same pointer to a place in the file. Questions? Yeah.
In terms of like the copies of the file itself, is the file in disk and is it just the same the copy of the file descriptor that's referring to it, or is there a copy of the actual file?
Question, when we open the file, are there extra copies of the actual file?
When you call fork
No. Generally, no. So the open file descriptor, we're still accessing the file indirectly. It's still a shared file. We just have data that's specific to our opening of the file, right? So for example, if I have a file foo.txt on Dix, not every call to open is going to be reading it. Not every call to open is going to be writing it. That information is stored with our open file description. And the other information we're seeing that's stored with our open file description is where we are currently in the file. But the actual data for the file, that's stored centrally, there's only one copy. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so we're gonna move on to our main topic for this week, which is going to be about this mapping. So we're going to look at sort of address spaces. I'm going to start with, like, here's our typical program layout, which you may or may not have seen something sort of like in CS01 or your equivalent. We have our stack on our machines, the department machines. Our stack kind of expands downward, so as you push things on the stack, it actually adds values towards lower addresses. And the convention that's been used for a while on most Unix-like systems is that we have a heap that, as we malloc things, grows upwards towards the stack, and hopefully they never meet. If we do, we're out of memory. And we also need to load some other data, so like we have our global variables, and we have our codes and constants, and sort of our conventional place to put those would be at addresses lower than the heap. This is kind of our conventional layout. And we're going to give every program this layout, and you know, it's not actually going to be stored this way in real memory. We're going to have some mapping, and that's going to be our main topic, is how does that work? Something you might notice here that we haven't really talked about is what's at the top of here. I have this big region used by the OS, and kind of what most modern OSs do is reserve roughly the top half of the physical addresses for the OS's use. Oh, sorry, the virtual addresses for the OS's use. So the so this means that we can't actually put anything in our, you know, the top half of these addresses. That's all reserved for the OS. And a typical reason to do that is that the OS doesn't want to change the mapping when it runs its system call handler. It wants to keep the same mapping. And the way we achieve that is we put the OS's stuff at the top, and we somehow have that this mapping marked. We'll see the exact mechanism as something only possible to use in kernel mode. But we'll still have it loaded in every program, so we don't need to change the mapping just to handle a system call. We will need to change it, of course, when we switch from one process to another. So we showed this before. We have our mapping. So every time process A is accessing memory, it goes through this mapping. And this mapping is going to let it access its code, its data. Its mapping's also going to have options for accessing stuff where the mapping will only work in kernel mode. So that's what that top half of memory is going to be. And typically, every process will map the same data for the OS, but only accessible in kernel mode. So we don't need to change the mapping to have the OS access its bookkeeping information, like what it needs to do to handle a system call or a read from the keyboard. And we'll have kind of a default action where we'll trigger a set fault, you know, for some of these mapping locations. And in this picture here, the processes kind of access independent memory when they're running. But we can have them deliberately share, which we did for the signals lab. Right? We had, for the signals lab, we set up some shared memory regions. And the way that worked is that we just arranged for the OS to have this shared region, and both processes had a pointer to it in the map. And we saw that there's just some system calls on Linux you can do to make that happen. And generally, we're going to select one of these mappings during the context switch. If we have a multiprocessor system, each processor is going to have one of these mappings active on that processor. So let's talk about how this is going to work. And some terminology I want to be really clear on, because we're going to use these terms all the time without explaining them. So our virtual addresses are the ones before the translation. They are every address the program uses, including code addresses. So if you jump call a function, you're using its virtual address to do that. If you're, you know, if you're jumping, you're using the virtual address to do that. And if you're accessing pointers or accessing things on the stack, all virtual addresses. We're going to call the actual addresses physical addresses, the ones in the real memory. And there's no requirement, and in fact, it's usually going to be the case, that these addresses are different sizes. That our virtual addresses will have a different number of bits than our physical addresses. And to illustrate sort of how this works, we're going to talk about, well, how do we store this mapping? How are we going to represent it? We're going to have a concrete proposal. And I'm going to start my concrete proposal at a more reasonable size, which is I'm going to have a program which can access 10-bit pointers. So its virtual addresses are 10 bits. And here's my hypothetical program's layout. It's kind of like a mini version of the overall program layout I showed you earlier. I have some code. I have its mutable data and its heap. Then I have an empty space for the stack or heap to grow into. And then I have its stack. And I've conveniently divided these up into four equally sized segments. And that's very deliberate. And I'm going to actually call these equally sized segments pages. And since this is virtual addresses, these are the addresses the program sees, they're virtual pages. And I'm going to number them starting with 0. And I've made a very deliberate choice here in how I divided things up into pages, that I chose a power of 2. And that means that these numbering I'm doing here, you know, since each of these are 2 to the 8 bytes, when we switch from page 0 to page 1, the upper bits of our address just start changing. Because 2 to the 8 is 1 followed by 8 zeros. So when you start with 0, add 2 to the 8, we get 1 and all zeros. So the start of virtual page 1 is address 1 and 8 zeros. And this means I can look at the upper bits of the address and very quickly see any address, which of these 4 pages is it in. And this is going to be very convenient because our hardware wants to figure out really, really quickly which virtual page is an address in. We don't want to do any modulus computation. And there's a good reason for that, which is that if we think of like a move instruction, we might have to do 2+ lookups of whatever the mapping is. We want those lookups to be super fast. So I'm going to call this upper bit the virtual page number. So this upper part of the address is the virtual page number. And if those are the upper bits, we're going to call the rest of the address the page offset. Yes?
How do you distinguish between virtual page 2 and virtual page 3?
How do I distinguish between virtual page 2 and virtual page 3? So all the addresses in virtual page 2 start with 10 and then some bits, right? So like here, it's probably 10100000 something. Right, so they all start with 10 if they're in virtual page 2. When you get to virtual page 3, they start starting with 11. Does that answer your question?
Wait, so like there's like 2 that are distinguished as 11. Like,
question, there's 2 that are distinguished as 11? Oh, so your question is why do I have 2 addresses that are here? Those are both in virtual page 3. So the one at the top is the last address in virtual page 3. And it's the highest possible virtual address because we only have 10 bits, right? So if I wanted the address that was just after virtual page 3, that would have 11 bits, and I can't do that. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, other questions? Okay, so we've divided it up into a page number and this page offset. And the page offset kind of tells us where in the page we are. So for example, all these addresses I've marked that have zeros are at the very beginning of one of these virtual pages. This address that has all ones is at the very end. And if I have an address in the middle, it's going to have a page offset that's in between. So the page offset tells us where in one of these pages we are. Now, the reason we're going to divide up memory into these pages is that this is the unit our mapping is going to work in. We're not going to map individual bytes. We're going to map these page size chunks. So I've chosen my pages to be 2 to the 8 bytes. That means that the mapping I give the processor is going to say this 2 to the 8 bytes is stored at one location. And we're going to say that whole region goes to that whole place, rather than having like specific values for each byte. And this is gonna make things more tractable. And so let's say we have some physical memory, and in my example here, my physical memory is actually bigger than my virtual addresses. That's one possibility. And I'm gonna divide my physical memory up in the same manner I divided up my virtual memory. So I divided up my virtual memory into chunks of page size. I chose my page to be 2 to the 8 bytes. I'm going to do the exact same thing for my physical addresses. I'm going to divide them up into chunks of 2 to the 8 bytes, which means I'm going to end up with 8 physical pages that I'm going to number from 0 to 7. And the same way we found out that the upper bits of the virtual address tell us which virtual page, the upper bits of the physical address are going to tell us which physical page. And because our pages are 2 to the 8 bytes, we're going to have 8 bits left over that is our page offset. That says where in a page we are. And now that we've divided up our virtual addresses into these pages and our physical addresses into these pages, we're just going to assign each virtual page to up to one physical page. So here I've assigned three of my virtual pages to a physical page. One of them I've left unassigned. So presumably, since it's unassigned, that's a segment. But the others I've assigned somewhere, and that's going to be what my mapping is. And since I'm assigning the whole page, this means that, for example, if I have the address, say, 110100, that's going to end up going, if we look here, down here to 000, and then 010001000. We're going to copy the page offset, but choose a new sort of page number. Right, because it's the whole page. So somewhere in the middle of the page, that far into the page, 0100 bytes into the page. In the virtual addresses, ends up that same number of bytes into the page in the physical addresses. Because we're assigning the whole chunk as is. We're not like changing its order or anything. And this means that when we're representing this mapping and using it, we're going to just have this tail we can use, where we say each virtual page corresponds to which physical page, and we just need to give the number. That's all the information we need. So you can see here I have a representation of what I've drawn, and this is a much better representation because if we're the operating system author communicating with the processor, probably we aren't communicating with the processor by drawing things. Probably we have to write numbers somewhere, and these are the numbers we're going to put somewhere for the processor. We'll talk exactly where do we put these numbers later. Yeah? Question, why is it okay to have this mapping to none? So we're going to have to figure out how to represent this in our table, like exactly, but why is it okay? Well, we did that in our real system. We want to support that functionality. That here, we have this huge space here that is totally inaccessible, that has nothing allocated for it. And we're representing the same idea in our new page table. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, but how do we make sure that our original memory has nothing allocated?
How do we make sure that there's nothing allocated in that space? Question, if there were something allocated, we still would assign it to nothing? No. So like the idea would be that when we loaded the program, we'd figure out where does the program store things and set this mapping up. Does that answer your question? So presumably if we have an entry for none, we've decided that it's okay to have nothing stored for that region and the program should still work. And most commonly that would be because like it's the area after the heap and before the stack, right? We don't need to put anything there or something like that. Other questions? Okay, so this table is called the page table. And that's what the form our mappings are going to take. But there's some details we're going to have to work out about how this page table actually works. So let's actually represent our page table. So one thing we need to deal with is that I wrote none on this slide. And that's great for us, but that's probably still not that thing we can really do in the processor. We have to store a number somewhere probably for the processor. So to handle the nones, I'm going to add a new column to my table called the valid bit. And I'm going to put a 1 there when the number is meaningful, and a 0 when it's not meaningful, when I mean to have the row be none. And that I have to do something like that because all the possible values for the physical page number column are valid, right? I can't just put a 0 there. 0 is a valid physical page that I'm in fact using. I don't have any values left over, so I need an extra bit to indicate this is not in use. So I don't have an equivalent of null. Can't do that. So that I use the I have this extra valid bit to handle that case. So we have this table here, and we're going to give this to the processor somehow. We'll talk exactly about how we do that later, but we're going to give this to the processor, and now we have it in a format where we're just writing bits somewhere, and the processor's going to read this. And what the processor is going to do is every time our program accesses an address, it's going to do a lookup in this table. So we're going to get an address, and it's going to divide the address up into our two pieces, into our virtual page number and our page offset. And we just need to figure out that virtual page, what physical page does it map to? We're going to do a table lookup to find that out. So we're going to go into this table, we're going to get the correct row, and we're going to look at the valid bit. And if the valid bit is 0, we're going to trigger an exception, or our friend the segfault. If the valid bit is not 0, then we're going to get this number out of here, and that's going to be part of our new physical address, the address that we can actually send to the real memory. But it's not the whole thing. It's only the top of it. We still need to figure out, are we at the beginning of the page or in the middle of the page or kind of, you know, near the end of the page? Here we're kind of near the end of the page. But to know that, we need the other bits of the original address, the page offset. So we're going to copy that page offset just as is into the new address. And this process is going to happen for every single time any instruction we run needs to access memory somewhere. Be it for loading code, for storing data, for loading data, every memory access is going to go through this table lookup. Question? Yes? Question, is it arbitrarily chosen what virtual pages go where? Yes. So the OS has full control over this table. It can decide on any ordering it wants. So I showed you the convention, right? You have a stack up near the top, a heap near the bottom, the code below that. But that's just how the OS set up the table. It can do whatever it wants. So if you want your program to load with addresses in different places, if you can convince the OS to set up the table for you, you can make that happen. Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So if a certain physical page is just going to be marked with an invalid bit all the time, why would we assign it a virtual page number? Can we have just skipped it and kept on numbering the ones that are invalid?
So question, if a certain physical page is just going to be marked invalid, so premise question issue here. The page table, importantly, is about virtual pages. Every row is a virtual page. That's what it's about. It doesn't really tell us about physical pages. We can't look up a physical page in the table easily, right? We can go to a specific row. We have to scan the table to find a physical page. And as for why we can't skip it, is that the problem is that we decided our program's layout needs to look like this. And part of what we decided is the stacks on top. The only way to have the stack on top is to have the row that represents 1, 0 be none. We have to have something there. And I guess another thing that maybe I didn't say explicitly is this table, we have an entry for every virtual page, no matter what. We never skip entries for virtual pages. We have to have a row for every single virtual page. We can't skip one. Part of what's happening here is that what I've shown in this box here, this is what's stored. We only store the information in the box. The 0001101, I have written on the slide so we can see things, but we're not actually going to store that. That's like an array index. Does that clarify things? So I guess I should have said that explicitly. So the 0001101, that's basically an array index. We don't actually store that. And that means we can't have a sparse table here. And you might think when we talk about the sizes of this that maybe we should have a sparse table, and we're going to have a solution for that, but it's not going to be the obvious one. It's going to be something a bit different because of the constraints of this system, and we'll talk explicitly about how do we not store every row? But for now, we're storing every single possible row as is. It's not like a hash table or a dictionary. It's an array. Yeah.
So what happens when that stack gets into that pre-remember? We want to set this to 1 now, right?
So question, if our stack wants to grow, how do we make that work? So one answer, the simplest answer is we could say, sorry, your stack is 256 bytes, and when you run out of that, you're out of luck. A less simple answer is that we can have the OS somehow figure out that you're using more stack space and adjust the page table entry at that point, and we'll explicitly talk about how to do that later. Yeah?
So we have to actually have the array indices for the place in the stack we'll grow into, for example, like pre-assigned. Like, do those have to be empty?
The question is, we have to have the empty space pre-assigned. So
we can't later add more, right?
We can't later add more. So the page tables we're seeing here, the page table is always 4 entries. No matter how many we're using, we have to fill in all 4 entries. And part of the reason why is the processor, it can't do an array out of bounds. The processor is going to look in the table in that location, and if we wanted to segfault, there better be something there, or else the processor won't know how to segfault. So even if it's invalid, we have to have something there. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I've shown our toy example, and I should talk about one terminology thing. So a row of this table, we're gonna call a page table entry. We will sometimes abbreviate this PTE. Okay, so we have our virtual addresses, and the way I describe things, it might seem that the size of a virtual address is the size of a pointer. So on our portal, that would be 64 bits. And that's not actually how things work. So for example, specifically on portal, pointers are 64 bits, but 64 bits is huge. And we really don't want to have a table that's that big. Now, we're gonna have ways of making these tables much more compact than they seem right now, but even those ways are not gonna be very good for 64 bits. They're still gonna be pretty bad for 64 bits. And for this reason, the designers of XD664 decided that they're going to make the virtual address space, the virtual addresses, only use 48 bits. So we have 64-bit pointers, but the actual part of the pointer that's used for the address lookup is only 48 bits. And the other bits of the pointer are just ignored, basically. There is actually a rule that the upper bits of the pointer need to all be the same, and the reason for this is that they wanted the option of adding extra bits in the future. And in order to do that, they wanted to make sure no one was sneaking extra data at the top of the pointers that they weren't using. So they just enforced the bits are the same to make sure you don't do what's called tag pointers. You don't say, gosh, I could squeeze some extra information in here about this pointer and still dereference it. They don't want you to do that, so they just enforce that the upper bits are all zeros or all ones. But they don't actually use the upper bits for figuring out what address to access. And when we talk about the size of virtual addresses, we mean the size that's actually used for mapping. So I'm gonna say Portal has 48-bit virtual addresses, even though we have 64-bit pointers, because 48 bits is the size we actually use for the page table lookup. And I'm gonna often talk about the address space size. And that's for the amount of stuff we can address. And I'm trying to be very explicit about this, that this is based on the number of unique addresses we can access. So if we have a 32-bit virtual address, we have a 2 to the 32 byte virtual address space. There are 2 to the 32 unique bytes of virtual memory we can access. Now, it may well be the case that at no time do all of them, or even a majority of those, represent valid memory. And that's fine, we still have that virtual address space size. So the address space is kind of our capability. And the same is going to be true of our physical addresses. If I have a 20-bit physical address, I'm going to say I have a 2 to the 20 byte physical address space. But often, it won't be the case I actually have 2 to the 20 bytes of physical memory. And that might not be intuitive. Like, why would we have these extra address bits if they can be smaller if we don't use them? And one way to think about why we need this is, let's say my machine had 3 gigs of memory. If you know your powers of 2, if we're rounding 3 gigs to the nearest power, you know, thing that's close to a multiple of 2, this is basically 3 times 2 to the 30 bytes. So if we use 31 bits, if we use 32 bits to represent our physical addresses, then we have a whole gigabyte of addresses that don't point to any actual memory because I only have 3 gigs, not 4. You know, there's basically no way of having all our physical addresses be meaningful on the system. And that's the norm. Even if you have a power of 2 bytes of memory, probably your system supports having more memory than that. You have a 64 gig install, but you could have up to 256 or something. And the way that generally works is that your system will have the physical address space for the maximum memory you could have, or maybe a bit extra, but not all of it will ever be usable. When we're talking about the address space size, we include the unusable space. It's the limit of our physical addresses, regardless of whether they all actually have sort of devices installed to handle them. So questions about our address space sizes? Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. So if I have 32-bit virtual addresses and 4,096 byte pages, that's 2 to the 12 bytes, how many virtual pages does my system have? This, by the way, is the typical configuration of a 32-bit x86 machine. If you'd like some more time? Okay, not seeing any volunteers. So, way I think about this is I have 32-bit virtual addresses. Each address accesses 1 byte. So I have a 2 to the 32 byte virtual address space. And that space is divided up into these equally sized pages, each of which is 2 to the 12 bytes. So I have 2 to the 32 bytes in total times 1 page for every 2 to the 12 bytes. And this is going to get me 2 to the 20 pages, or about 1 million. A little more than 1 million. Some questions on how I computed that? not seeing questions, so let's do this exercise. So I have the same virtual address size and the same page size. Let's say I have 30-bit physical addresses, and I want to make my page table, and my page table is going to have a physical bit, page number, and a valid bit. And that's it. I don't have an extra word on this slide. How big is the page table? If it's laid out like the ones we've seen, we'll talk later that there's going to be some other ways of laying out page table. But we'll start with our simple way we've seen of laying out page table. How big is it? Yes, question. How big is, do I mean how many pages? I mean, how much space does it take up in bits? Or in bytes? Yes. Yeah, there are other ways of measuring it too, but I'm going to be concerned, like, how much storage do we need for it? Who'd like some more time? Can someone tell me a good first step here? What's the first step for solving this problem? Yeah. How many rows are in the page table? Right. So a way we can think about this is our page tables, we've talked about that they're kind of arrays, and we have some sort of width of it and the number of rows, and if we want the total size, like it's a rectangle, height times width. So finding the height seems like a good first step. It's great. So what do each row correspond to? It corresponds to a virtual page. So the number of rows, in fact, is the calculation we did on the previous slide. It's 2 to the 20. So then we just need to figure out how wide it is. And we're told that we have a valid bit, so that's probably 1 bit wide. And we have a physical page number, which I'll abbreviate PPN. How many bits wide is that? Tell me a way of computing how many bits wide the physical page number is. Yeah. 33, how do you get 33?
So there's 2 bits for the page number,
the virtual numbers,
and 1 extra bit.
1 extra bit, where did the extra bit come from?
The valid bit.
So I think we're getting confused by the example I started you with. Right here we had an extra bit, but that was because I said I had more physical addresses than virtual addresses. That's where that extra bit came from. Also, our page numbers here, remember, in this example, our page numbers are only actually 3 bits, right? Because the rest is page offset. So that doesn't quite work. And so let me go over a couple ways of thinking about this. So one way we can think about it is we have a physical page number, and we know that when we take the physical page number and combine it with a page offset, this is going to be a physical address. And we know physical addresses are 30 bits. So something that's the size of the physical page number plus something that's the size of a page offset is 30 bits. So if we knew the size of a page offset, we could do some algebra and compute the size of the physical page number. And the page offset, remember, tells us where in a page we are. How many locations do we have on each page? Well, we have location 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, up to 4,095. Those are all our locations in a page. Byte 0, byte 1, byte 2, byte 3, 4, up to 4,095. So our page offset is, in fact, 12 bits. 12 bits because it's 0 through 4,095. Or 0 through 2 to the 12 minus 1. So that's one way we do our algebra, and we find out that we need 18 bits here for our physical page number. So that's one way we could figure it out. And an observation we can make that's going to be useful later is that our page offset's always the same size in our virtual and physical addresses. So the same thing tells us we have 20-bit page virtual page numbers, because we take 32 bits, subtract 12, get 20. And that matches what we already saw, because 20 bits, well, if we have 20 bits representing a value, how many possible values do we have? 2 to the 20. And that matches our 2 to the 20 rows. There's one row for each possible way of writing things in 20 bits. Another way we could have computed our physical address size is we can say we have 2 to the 30 physical address space bytes, and we can say we divide this by 2 to the 12, like we did on the previous slide for the virtual address space size, and we say there are 2 to the 18 physical pages. And then we ask the question of how many bits do we need to represent the index of one of 2 to the 18 things? Well, we take log base 2 of 2 to the 18. So that implies log 2 of 2 to the 18 bits for the page numbers, for physical page numbers. And log base 2 of 2 to the 18 is 18. So that's another way we could have computed it. So questions about either of those ways of finding that out that we have 18 bits for our physical page numbers in this example?
Does that include the valid bit?
Does that include the valid bit? No, the valid bit is not part of the page number. Right, so this is our table here, our page number, not the valid bit. So that's worth emphasizing, since this is in fact a very common error. The valid bit is not part of any address whatsoever. Do not put it in addresses. It's not part of the address. It's a thing in the table. It never ends up in any addresses. Not in the page number, not in the page offset. It's just extra information about a row of the table. Yeah. Basically, anything that's not part of the offset is the page number? Yes. And that's because we've divided up our addresses into two pieces. Not anymore. And so, if I combine this together, I have 18 bits for the physical page number plus 1 bit for the valid bit, that extra row, or extra column. And I need 2 to the 20 times 18 plus 1 bits. And that works out to about, so this is about sort of 3 to 4 megabytes, 2 to 3 megabytes, And actually, it's probably worse because it's really awkward to store an array of 19-bit values. We're probably going to round up to 24, and even that's awkward. We're probably going to round up to 32. So it's probably going to take up 4 meg. So this is going to be a problem. This is a pretty large size already, and this is a 32-bit system. But this size is at least tractable, and we can deal with this size by storing our page table in memory, which is going to be our typical solution. We're going to have a better solution for compacting it, we'll talk about, which is called multi-level page tables. The kind of preview for that is we're going to use something like a tree data structure. Okay, so some more exercises since we talked about basics of splitting up addresses. Split up this address into a page number and a page offset. Would you like some more time? Okay, so what do I do here? So we know our address is going to be split up into a page number and a page offset. And I actually don't specify whether it's a virtual or physical page number in this question. And it actually didn't tell us how big the page numbers are. But fortunately, we don't actually need to know that, because we know the page offset's always the lower bits. And the page offset is based on how many bits are in the page, how many bytes are in the page. We know there's 2 to the 12. We need 12 bits to figure out which byte we're referring to. So our page offset is 12 bits. Log base 2 of 2 to the 12 bits. That's what we need to figure out. Which of the bytes are we referring to? And the remaining bits are going to be our page number. And a convenient property of hexadecimal that we're going to be taking advantage of is that each hexadecimal radix is 4 bits. So I could write this whole thing out as binary. So 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 0001 And then select these bits are our page offset, and this whole thing is our page number. I could do that, or I could recognize that, wait a moment, this whole thing is exactly 12 bits. And so our page offset is 0x678, which happens to be what happens if I read out those bits as hexadecimal. And the remainder is 0x12345. That's our page number. Questions? I got that answer. Yes?
How would you split the page?
What's 10 bits? How do we split if it's 10 bits? Then you might want to write out in binary. Okay, so let's do one other exercise. And so here I have a page table. And remember that when we actually store this, what we're going to be storing is really this part. And I have 6-bit page offsets and 9-bit virtual addresses. My question is, that virtual address, what physical address should it correspond to?
Okay, so
So we're doing this process, this lookup. I guess for time reasons, I will talk, we'll do this quickly here. So I have a 6-bit page offset. So this is my page offset. This is my virtual page number. Why is it virtual? Because this is a virtual address. So I look for the row with 000, that's here. It's valid, so there is a physical address. If it was invalid, I have to say, no, there's no physical address. It's gonna trigger a seg fault. But it does have a physical address. So I copy this physical page number and I combine it, with this whole page offset. And that's my physical address. I can also rewrite this in hexadecimal. So this is a 4. This is a C. Or C is that, that's an A. Because I know what 10 looks like. So that's OXA4 is another way we could write things. So questions, how I did that translation? Yeah?
What about the extra bit? Because I think that there is.
What about which extra bits? Oh, why the question is, why is the physical address larger?
Yeah, there's an extra.
Why is it larger? It's larger because our physical page numbers are larger than our virtual page numbers. So that means that we have 10-bit physical addresses. I didn't write that explicitly in the question, but we can infer that from how the page table looks. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so to finish up today, I think I'm a little behind the other section for which we'll deal with. Let's talk about another thing we want to handle, which is, let's say I'm running two different copies of a program on Portal. So we're both running Vim. I have my copy of Vim and their copy of Vim. And we'd really like to share the memory for Vim's code. Seems like a great idea. It's going to save us memory. It's going to keep us from copying things when 20 different people all run copies of Vim. Does it make Vim launch faster because it's already going to be loaded? Great idea, and it's something operating systems do. But there's something we have to worry about. What if Vim is buggy, and I trigger a bug in Vim, and it tries to overwrite that code? You know, if it's just me, well, I screwed myself over. Who cares? The problem is, it's not just me, right? If MST3K writing here is also going to modify the memory that this other user is accessing, we're breaking everyone's copies of Vim, not just this user who broke Vim. That's really bad. And we'd really like it to be the case that this can't happen. But we still want to share the memory. So how can we do this without sharing the memory? And the answer is that we're going to add some extra bits to the page table to say what you can do when you access a specific virtual page. So in addition to the valid bit, we're going to check these other bits we call permission bits, and we're going to say whether or not that access is allowed. So when MST3K's copy of Vim tries to write to the code, we're going to have a bit that it's going to check, you know, like this row here, and it's going to find out it's not writable. And that write's going to fail, and it's going to trigger a seg fault. And that's going to keep that stray copy of Vim from ruining Vim for everyone on the system, but still allow us to share the memory. So we'll finish up talking about this next time, and some other things we can end up doing by taking advantage of these permission bit ideas.